Hi, listeners. You can now listen to this community podcast production ad-free on Apple Podcasts and access the podcast 1 week early and get exclusive bonus content. Just hit the subscribe button now on Apple Podcasts. Or if you want access to all of the above, plus video versions of the podcast, head to patreon.com/stopthekilling.
On the morning of August 1st, 1966, shots ring out from the observation deck of the clock tower on the University of Texas campus. It marks the infamous beginning of the modern era of mass shootings in America.
I'm Sarah Ferris, true crime podcaster.
And I'm Catherine Schweit, the former head of the FBI's active shooter program.
And you're listening to Stop the Killing. Welcome to another episode of Stop the Killing. Before we start, we want to give a big heartfelt thank you and shout out to our latest Patreons who help us fuel the podcast. And it is Alex K and Gary Genon, just got a lovely alliteration to it, who have joined us as supporters. So thank you so much.
I actually want to say a separate thank you because I know how much work is involved in the back room for Sarah to do all the editing. She does all of this work and spends hours and hours at an editing desk, putting all of this together, adding the show notes, finding the right links, putting together the material so that it can go out and get it put onto the right sites and uploaded into social media so that it's available and accessible in any format that somebody wants to find it, whether that's in YouTube, any place you find your favorite podcast.
Well done. You're getting better at that.
I'm trying. Thank you. But, you know, the Patreons, one contribution just really helps us because, you know, I'm retired and Sarah's doing this because she just loves to do it. And it just eats up an incredible amount of time. We do it because we think it's really important. And I think when someone contributes, when they're able to, as a Patreon, I think it also just kind of demonstrates how they think it's important too. And we appreciate that. We recognize that.
Yeah, for sure. We definitely value all of the upstanders that come on board as Patreons. And, you know, as you point out, there are ways to support the podcast as well if you can't financially do it, and that is to share the podcast with people. And we know that's been happening a lot in our communities because we've heard from, you know, an entire A&E department in, I think it was Texas at one stage, whose head of department makes them all listen to Stop the Killing.
I would, so, you know what? I think if I had a wish for today, somebody who's listening today, I would just say, if you've never done it before, just today, could you find one person who you could convince to follow? You know, just one person. And I think you'd be surprised that it would give you somebody to talk to about what you've learned or what you've talked about or what you're worried about, to share your own stresses and your thoughts about safety and how to overcome those. And it would give them an avenue maybe they've never seen before. There's a whole podcast world out there and so much available on media and social media. And it's hard to know what's worth it and what's not. But I hope you think this is worth the time. And if you're taking the time today to listen to it, then maybe at the end of the show, pick one person who you could share this with and say, you know, here's something that it would be worth following and listening to. Just listen to a season of it and then see what you think.
I love that. So true. And talking of our wonderful Patreons, that's going to segue nicely into today's episode, because the reason we're talking about the Oxford school shooting again, that case, is one of our listeners and Patreons, Kathy Jezdemir, had emailed and asked us to give regular updates on the case. And I know
we do what our Patreons ask us to do.
You've got all the power. Exactly. We love hearing what you guys want to hear from us as well. So do keep those suggestions coming. So yeah, Catherine, let's get into it. We've got an update on the Oxford trial. Now, we should say that when we're going to record this, let's put a line in the sand, it is the 27th of February.
And that's right now.
Significant. Right now, today, as we speak, it's the 27th of February. Because we've got a trial date coming up very soon, March 5. So tell me about that.
Yes. And I also want to say, we plan on doing a whole separate segment on what we have learned about the shooter's own record at school, the shooter's background. We're going to do that separately, not because we want to glorify the shooter, but we want to talk about what was going on in his past and what might have been seen and what kind of help was provided or wasn't provided. So that we'll do the shooter separately. So don't give up on us with regard to that. But we're trying to provide you with good kind of real time updates as we go. So the shooter killed four people on November 30th of 2021 at the school in the afternoon. And the gun that was used was purchased a few days earlier by the father. Then the mother the next day took the young man, who was 15 at the time, to a shooting range. Now, in case you don't know, you're not allowed to own a gun at 15 in the United States. Took him to the shooting range. He posted pictures bragging about his new Christmas present that his parents had given him. His mom said she was out with him shooting with his new Christmas present. And he had clearly talked them into this. And then she was shooting with him on a Saturday. Sunday goes by. Monday, there's some issues at school on Monday that have come up at trials. And we'll talk about Tuesday, the shooting occurs. So very quickly after the gun is purchased, the shooting occurs on November 30th. Because of the activities of the parents are charged by the Oakland County prosecutor, Karen McDonald, a brave soul and brilliant attorney and her team. The parents are charged with involuntary manslaughter, the first time anyone has ever been charged in this fashion for involuntary manslaughter for the actions of their child, actions of another in this way. I mean, there are circumstances under the law when you can do that. If you're driving the car in a bank robbery and the bank robbery goes bad and somebody in the bank gets killed, the whole bank robbery gang gets charged with the murder. In this case, we have parents who are off at their jobs. Their child pulls out a gun, kills four people, and the parents are charged with involuntary manslaughter. Initially, there was like, what? How can that be? And there was a lot of discussion about that. But Karen McDonald and her team plowed through, charged the parents individually. And the mother just recently was convicted of all four counts of involuntary manslaughter. The parents' trial was what we call bifurcated, two separate trials, because they had conflicting potential defenses. So now, right on the heels of the mother's trial being completed, she won't even be sentenced till April. The father is now going to go on trial. And they're in the process of pre-trial motions right now. So for people who don't live in the court world, motions are like the whole thing. You know, when you try a case, there's so much activity that goes on before the case. Certainly in a murder trial, it's very sensitive. So every party files motions asking the judge to allow or disallow information from being in front of the jury. And so that's what's going on right now in the case of the father. His name is James. And trial is scheduled for a couple of weeks from now, but the judge is very quickly having to decide on these pretrial motions, including what can be allowed in front of the jury. This was a jury trial for the mom, and the dad, James, is also going to have a jury trial, at least right now. That's what appears. Now, here's a caveat. She's been convicted already. A lot of the same evidence might come out at his trial. His attorney or he might decide to plead out at some point, and we could be doing a quick short piece to say, hey, guess what? James pled out, and he's agreed to take X number of years in jail. But I don't think so.
You don't think that's he will?
I mean, at first I thought yes. And I think when
the writing is on the wall, isn't it? When the mother's already been convicted and he was the one that purchased the gun.
Like, right. He's the one that purchased the gun.
Logic would dictate that he's got less chance.
Well, there's a couple of things about that. Now, here's how lawyers think. Different jury, different decisions. Different.
Oh, right? It's so interesting you say that. Last night on TV, there's a whole new program called The Jury, and the premise is they have actors playing out a real case, but they've got two juries judging the same case. To your point, I'm pretty sure that both juries are going to have different answers. So that's fascinating. What's your feelings on it then?
Well, when you're tried by a jury of your peers, they're not your clones. They're your peers. The first challenge in picking a jury is, and there's a process to choose your jurors, and you get a certain number of peremptory challenges to dismiss jurors and say, I don't want that person. Say that you're a banker charged with embezzling money from your own bank. And then you have a jury pool that comes in and they are allowed to ask all the jurors certain questions. And you say, well, you know, do you bank at this bank? You know, have you met this banker before? And the potential juror says, oh, you know, yes, he was my banker. I used to go see him every Saturday. Okay. They dismiss that person. So the judge would dismiss people for that cause, not a negative thing, but just a potential conflict or something where it might be more challenging for them. Maybe your child was murdered in a school shooting. You probably don't want to have that person on a jury because they're going to view the world in such a different way. So there's a certain number of people in a jury, and yeah. You probably know this now because you're watching television about it. There's a certain number of people on a jury who are dismissed kind of out of hand by the judge. I can tell you that I've been called for jury duty a number of times in the United States. How many times do you think I have served on a jury?
Zero.
A big flat zero.
Yeah.
A big fat zero, right? Absolutely. No one wants a former prosecutor and an FBI agent.
So, you know, obviously with this case, then, you know, knowing the mum's been already found guilty, one of the factors then that is weighing quite heavily is selecting the jury for the defense. That's going to be key. What other elements do you think are key that they might be thinking, right,
so
this is a card we can play?
As I mentioned, they're doing pretrial motions right now, and they're saying, oh, we want this person to testify or that. And then the other side can say, no, we don't want that person. One example is they have a motion in front of the judge saying, we want these two students who are now adults, but they were students at the time, who were in the hallway when people were murdered. They want these two students to testify. What's the relevance of their evidence? This is how courts analyze things. So I teach at DePaul University Law School. And one of the courses that I have taught there is two police officers in their master's program about evidence. When is evidence allowed in court? When is it not allowed in court? And that's a 403 issue. Is the evidence relevant? Evidence can only come in if it's relevant. What is the relevance of two students in the hallway describing a shooting that occurred when a 15-year-old came out of the bathroom with a handgun? How is that relevant to James's trial for involuntary manslaughter?
Is that not establishing the manslaughter itself, though?
That the crime occurred.
Yeah.
Yep. Is that it can be that, right? So there's a video footage of it that can be evidence that the crime occurred. I think you're absolutely right. You have to prove the crime occurred in order for the parents, right? So that's true.
Yeah. I can see why you wouldn't want, as the defense counsel, you would not want these witnesses, very powerful, I would imagine, on a stand to sway a jury getting up there and talking. So I can imagine why you would want to throw them out. But it's
very emotional, right? It's very emotional. And they're going to give eyewitness testimony watching classmates murdered. Cool. So here's the response to that, though, for defense counsel. Under the law, evidence that can be admitted might not be admitted if it's considered cumulative.
Right.
Why do two people have to testify if there's a video footage showing it? So is it cumulative? This is one of the things that the judge is deciding. Like the parties have argued, but the judge is going to decide on if it's so prejudicial that it would prejudice the jury, because there are lots of cases you spend time in law school learning about, if you instruct in that, if you teach about evidence collection. How much is too much? How many bloody footprints should we show? How many graphic photographs should we show? When does it get to be just gratuitous blood and gore to disgust the jury? So we have a video and we have two potential witnesses for the shooting itself. Do they have to validate that and show that it occurred? Yes. One of the things that's fascinating listening to the motions arguments is the idea of, oh, that could be prejudicial. Or it could be redundant, like it could be cumulative. There are other arguments, but those are two pretty obvious ones. They acknowledge in the courtroom that the parties at all times could stipulate to it, meaning that they don't have to provide any evidence of it, because the parties could agree that, yes, James and his son killed four people in the school.
Yeah.
And if both sides agree to that, this they would just event tell
did
the jury.
Happen. Nobody's arguing right. that the event happened.
Exactly. That right. they just tell everybody in the jury, you don't have to have any doubt about it. His son did these murders.
Mm-hmm.
And the parties could stipulate to that. But each side gets to bring the case their own way. That's the law, right? That's what is allowed in court. And of course, James's attorney is going to bring forward his argument in front of his completely independent jury to say he did this, but there's no way he could have known this was going to happen.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
Have you ever felt that pang of disappointment when you couldn't add a ticket to your collection because it was digital? Or maybe you just lost it? Well, StubForge.com is here to change that. Imagine this: tickets that not only look but feel like the real deal. Because each ticket from StubForge is printed on the same quality stock that Ticketmaster uses, and printed with genuine ticket printers. It's like holding a piece of the concert, the game, or the show right in your hands. But StubForge isn't just about replacing tickets. With the easy-to-use interactive designer, you can create custom tickets for anything, from concerts to sports games, pregnancy announcements, or parties. Why not make your invitations stand out with tickets that are as unique as your event? And if you're trying to complete a back catalogue of missing tickets, StubForge offers bulk discounts to make it both easy and affordable. With StubForge, you can once more give your loved ones physical tickets and see their eyes light up instantly at the best gift you can give. So whether you're looking to reignite your ticket collection, craft the perfect gift, or send the coolest invites, head over to StubForge.com. Start creating today and see how StubForge makes every ticket a story worth saving. Visit StubForge.com and start making tickets today. Is it the same judge?
No. And I'll say a judge makes rulings based on the law and the rules of the court.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury makes decisions based on the evidence presented to them. So okay. A judge doesn't step in and weigh evidence differently than a jury does. What the judge does is say, here is what can come in front of the jury. Here's the rules and the regulations to make sure that this is a fair trial as we can make it.
So that's the motions that are being put in front of the judge currently.
Exactly.
Let's go back and compare that to the mother's trial.
Mm-hmm.
Did the judge allow similar evidence from students that were at the school?
So this is one of the interesting things about trial is that it's based on who you think you're really going to have in front of you. In the opening argument, it's not really an argument. It's an opening statement. Yeah. And what you say is, here's what you're going to see. But then in the closing, you do a closing argument where you say, here's what you heard and here's how I think you can interpret that. And so when you say, here's what you're going to see, it really depends on what rulings have been made on the motions. And you don't necessarily know how the other side is going to close their case. Except here, we have the same prosecutors trying a different person in front of a different jury with a lot of the same evidence. So the defense counsel for James has a lot of information about how the state might present its case and where its best arguments might be. But that's in some ways kind of a huge advantage. So the prosecutors saying, we want to add these people to the list. Defense counsel has filed a responsive motion saying these people are duplicative and this evidence doesn't need to come in. He's charged with involuntary manslaughter. He's not charged with standing in the hallway firing or pulling the trigger. And so the judge is going to have to make a ruling based on rules of evidence about whether this evidence is relevant and not cumulative, not, you know, all the other things that might be. So it's kind of an interesting snapshot of how challenging it is sometimes to get your witnesses to the courtroom.
In terms of like a strategy, I mean, I would imagine they would, I don't know what happened in the mother's trial. Did you watch any of it? Okay.
Oh, yeah, like, definitely.
What do you believe was the most impactful? Was there anything that was completely, that's the real writing on the wall?
Well, that is a good question. That's the value of a jury, that everybody hears things that impact them in different ways. For me, one of the things was the activity of the parents and kind of how they responded and really, you know, said, well, he's the one who got the gun. You know, that's what she said. And then there were, she went on the witness stand, but there were not flattering things that came up about her. Is it true you spent more money on the care of your horse than you spent on mental health care for your child? Yes. I mean, there's just a lot of things. She was involved with somebody. There were a lot of things that made you not kind of like her.
Yeah.
And I think she was in a position where she had to testify, but it's probably much easier to find somebody guilty when you don't particularly feel sympathetic towards that person. And I don't think her facts helped. I think in this case too, right, we have a teenager who was the shooter and he told, you know, and acted this way towards mom, but that way towards dad. And I think there's a fair argument that you could make in court that the son did things that the parents didn't know about, had communications with other people or wrote things that the parents didn't know about, and that he snowballed them, right, into convincing him to buy this gun at this particular time. He had some communications with his friend about, my parents are getting suspicious, you know. Well, that kind of gives you the impression that the parents didn't know. In the closing argument of the mother's case, her attorney said, this case is not just about her. It's about every mother who can be blamed for the actions of their child. And I think that's speaking to the parents, who I'm sure there were parents and the jury saying, should I be responsible for the actions of my child when my child takes a gun from the house while I'm at work and goes out and does this? Am I responsible? And when it's all said and done, if his case goes to trial and he doesn't plead out, it seems like he might plead out because they've seen all the evidence. But at this point, they're not ready to plead out, perhaps.
Well, if I was him now and I'd just heard everything that you'd said, this is his last roll of the dice by going to jury, isn't it?
And that's really what, I mean, that's what the jury process is all about.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's a, you know, famous U.S. Supreme Court case that says just because you're acquitted doesn't mean you're innocent, right?
Yeah.
So it's the difference is not that you're not guilty. It's that you're not found guilty. You're not, you're acquitted of a crime that you were accused of because the state carries a burden of proving that evidence. One of the things that is going to come up in this trial that maybe is different is one of the witnesses that the prosecutors added to their witness list is a guy, and he's going to testify that the gun that was used in the killing is a particular type of 9mm gun. And he actually bought the gun in May of 2021. He used it a few times and then he decided it wasn't really for him. So he returns it. He returned it on November 13th. And then the gun was purchased by the killer's dad on November 26th. Mm. So from the 13th to the 26th, the gun was only in the shop for just less than 2 weeks and it was resold. The reason that the prior owner of the gun is potentially going to be called as a witness, it was okayed in the motions, was because he's going to be able to testify that when he purchased the gun had like a cable lock.
Yeah.
That's like a bike lock. It's like a long cord goes through the barrel and locks. So the gun can't be fired. He had the cable lock that came with the gun and he can testify that when he returned the gun in November, it still had the cable lock on it. He returned it with the cable lock. So he's returned it to the store with the gun, which is really, you know, how is that relevant? Maybe the jury doesn't think it's relevant at all. To the prosecutor's frame of mind, that means they had the ability to lock the gun up. They had the ability to keep the gun from being able to discharge around. Somebody chose not to do that.
Thanks for listening. And if you want to know more, Catherine's book, Stop the Killing, is out now. For more details, go to catherineschweit.com. Please consider also supporting our independently made podcast. It's simple to do. Go to patreon.com/stopthekilling. And for as little as the price of a latte a month, you can be part of the solution to stop the killing. Patreon rewards range from official do-gooder status to ad-free episodes, autographed books, and opportunities to connect with us directly for your business, school, church, or even just a book club chat. But just knowing that you are part of a movement that has the power to make your community safer, well, that's got to taste better than a skinny cappuccino any day. So please head to patreon.com/stopthekilling now and polish off your do-gooder halo and make sure to include your name so we can give you a shout out. This podcast is a Conmunity podcast production. That's Con with an N. If you want more content, then head over to Conmunity Podcast at Instagram, where you'll find trailers on more binge-worthy true crime, like the award-winning podcast Conning the Con. And check out our show notes for all the links mentioned. Finally, if you want one takeaway action that you can do right now that can help make our community safer, please share, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen. Everybody needs to know that they hold the keys to see something and say something. Together, we can stop the killing.
It's one of those things you hope never happens, but you better train for it. Because it will happen. And it will happen in places you wouldn't expect. Be ready for it.
The truth about the Haditha massacre has been covered up, but not anymore.
I know you know what happened.
They went into houses and killed women and children.
What are you thinking?
What a mess.
U.S. Marines murdered innocent civilians in cold blood.
And at the center of it all
is 25-year-old Sergeant Frank Wooderich.
And me. Murder in House 2. A new podcast from Crowd Network.
Hi, this is Amy and Vanessa from She Goes By Jane, where we shine light on the stories of missing and unidentified women. On November 7th, we're sharing Nahida's story for the first time in a podcast. And this is a story that I thought I knew, but after reading police reports, became more complicated than I thought. When investigators are called to Nahida Khatib's house, everything looks fine. Her purse is on the kitchen table, her cup of coffee is on the counter, and her 2-year-old niece is in her playpen. The only thing amiss? Nahida is missing.
Every week, we feature a poem written in honor of the person we're talking about. This week, we're joined by one of our favorite actresses. You might know her from Sister Act or King of the Hill or The Descendants. But if you're like us, you'll know her from Hocus Pocus. She's the much-beloved Kathy Najimy. Join us November 7th to hear Nahida's story.